Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi, it's a Friday afternoon. I've been trying to find a time of the day to do this. I'm here in Orlando. It's not quite as warm as I thought. But anyway, at my kids, and, you know, staying in one of those types of places. Anyhow, I did undertake to do something for Gnosim here. And the item that really caught my eye was the Mantua Zohar, since I've been talking about Mantua. And someone else wanted me to talk about Moshe Provenzalo. Maybe I'll do that next week. Because I know these are not names necessarily that are so well known. And Bechlal, Mantua, what does that mean to anybody? But it had its 5 minutes of fame, as I've been trying to point out with Moscato. And that's only scratching the surface. So in the catalog, the Gnosim, as I said before, auction house is making a auction on March 3 and March 5, I believe. I'm going by memory. See, I came from Baltimore, and I took a grand total of one book with me because of the airlines and all this other junk. So I'm operating on half along, so to speak. But be that as it may, I remember seeing that there's one really remarkable item in there. I'm sure there are more. And that's the Zohar, the first time it was ever published, which was in Mantua in the late 1550s, like 1559, 1560, something like that. And this is really mamish an artifact. No, this is and it's a fancy set. You know, they don't sell anything in Gnosim unless it's in good shape. So it's a fancy set, which really was the subject of a gigantic machlokes in Italy under most unusual circumstances in the late 1550s. As happens, the cat was out of the bag, so nothing you could do about it anymore. But a lot of big rabbanim, like Damar and Padua, for example, who was the biggest Rosh Hashivan elders, were very strongly opposed to printing the Zohar and putting it out there literally in the Rishus HaRabim in a way it hadn't been before. Others obviously felt they should do it. Obviously, there was a lot of money to be made in it, as we'll talk about in a second. And so I figured this is lot number 144, if you look on the online in the Gnosim catalog. That's Gnazym. And again, it's coming up soon. The auction is March 3 and March 5, whatever days the week that is. One's got to be a Sunday. And this is an item going for 100K, something like that, you know, between 50 and 100,000, maybe a little more. It's really an unusual thing to have this, especially if it's in good condition, which I know it is. So what are we talking about over here? Today, in the year 2024, Kabbalah books is all over the place. And online, give me a break and a half. It's you know, everything is Kabbalah, if you want it. And the Zohar comes in all kind of editions, and the Masoch Midvash, and the Sulam, and this, and that, and the other. It's all in English. I mean, I'm serious. I'm not talking about the quality of the different works. I'm talking about the fact that it's available. Now, I don't think it's resulted and everybody becoming a Kabbalist, because at the end of the day, it's hard stuff. Nevertheless, should you bechlal have such a thing in Rishus HaRabim, or should it be in Rishus HaYochid? We all know there's an ancient tradition in the Mishnah, everybody knows this, in, what do you call it, in the Chagiga, you know, Ein Dorsha Ma'aseh Breishis in front of one, Ein Dorsha Ma'aseh Merkava in front of two, something like that, meaning you don't disseminate in public. The Jewish tradition, certainly you can, historically, you can certainly trace it back to the Talmud, and the Kabbalists will say even older than that, is that we have a two-track system in Judaism, A and B. One is Nigla, and one's Nister. Nigla, you're supposed to disseminate as much as possible. That's called Harbatzas HaTorah. You want to do whatever you can, make as many people know about this stuff as possible, like the Halacha, Gemara, and anything that pertains to that. So when it comes, like, for example, you know, like the Art Scroll or the Steinsaltz or now the Masifta, nobody's got any problem. You know, maybe they had a little bit of problem at the beginning, but I never heard anybody complain about the Masifta, for example. You understand? So, notice, leaving politics aside, the Harbatzah HaTorah is very good. Now, on the other hand, or Chumash, you know, things like that. Now let's move to track B, the opposite. It's not supposed to be disseminated. But that's the old tradition. It's only supposed to be covered only master dover. It's only for the few. And those few will find their way to it, or else they weren't meant to. It's a mystical way of looking at it. You understand? Those who will find their way to it will find their way to it. The story is told of the Arizal, who was a direct beneficiary of, if the story is true, of the Zohar that was published in print for the first time in Mantua. I remember reading it many years ago in the Shivchei HaAri, which came out, I think, in the 1590s, early 1600s, something like that. And the Ari died in 1572. So in other words, the superhero of Kabbalah, which is the Arizal, let's see now. You know, he died young in his 30s. He died in 1572, if I remember correctly. So that means he died 13 years after the Zohar was printed. Think about that. I don't say he did. The story is that the Ari was a yeshiva guy learning up a storm in Nigla. And then somewhere in Egypt, he davened in a shul. And he saw a guy davening up with a sitter upside down. And he went over to him. You know, the Arizal, he didn't mean anything bad at all. He said, you know, it's upside down. And so forth. The guy starts screaming at him, why are you embarrassing me? I'm a Marano. I just escaped from Portugal, wherever. And I'm trying to re-enter Judaism. And here you're publicly shaming me and so forth and so on. And everybody apologized, the story goes. He said, I didn't mean anything bad. I feel really bad about it. And so on and so forth. And by the way, what is this? A funny looking sitter. And he flipped it open. And it didn't look like a sitter. It wasn't a sitter. You know, the Portuguese guy went to a bookstore. He said, give me a prayer book. And they sold him whatever they sold him. A lot of farm stores are like that. So, Dari basically said like this. First of all, I apologize. Second of all, I want to buy this book off of you. Whatever you paid, I'll pay double, triple, whatever. And he did. And naturally, you and I know it was a Zohar. Now, which he hadn't seen before. That's how the story goes. Is if I'm going by memory. Here I am, stuck without any farm, anything else. So I have to go, but I'm pretty sure that's how it went. And that would mean that this story would have to be in the last 13 or so years of the life of the Ari. Now, considering he died, how old was he? In his 30s. In his early 30s, I think. So I remember both him and Cordovero both died in their 30s. One in 38, age of 38, and the other one younger. So whatever the case is, this story happened not too long before he died. What I mean is not 20, 30 years before he died, like a decade or a little more than that, which is just interesting on its own. That's a separate riff. We're not going to go down that hole. Now, the story then goes that he said, whoa, what is this? And it was a Zohar, and he started getting into it. And naturally, my point is like this. And naturally, his neshama was totally drawn to it, as we know. And then showing. So what I mean to say is like this. From a religious point of view, the story I just told was a screwball story, which means Minash Hamayim is meant that this guy called the Ari, it's a Gloria, it was meant to encounter the Zohar in this way. So it was, it was a Hashkacha Pratis, big time. And naturally, it led to what it led, to him becoming the giant of Kabbalah. So that's the old-fashioned theory, which is that, even though it's from a printed book, the old-fashioned theory, now I'm pretty sure it was a printed book. Now I'm thinking maybe it was a handwritten thing from the Zohar. Maybe it was older than that, but I seem to remember it was a printed book. So that means if you're supposed to know about it, you're supposed to know about it. Which is why even today, after all said and done, and there's a veldt of Kabbalistic literature out there of all types, some people are into it and some are not. You can sort of tell who your Shonish and Shama is, because some people are totally drawn into this, like, wow. And other people, after a while, they put it down. This ain't for me. It's just, it's boring or it's hard or this, that. Whatever the case is, it's not what they get into. So we all know this. Now, here you are, late 1550s, and a decision has been made or an attempt is being made to put in printing, the printing press, the Zohar, which is going to be a game changer as far as keeping it away from the public sphere and not disseminating it. Because if a book is printed, that's the major way of disseminating information. It's our butts a kabbalah, if you want to call it that. Now, this went totally against the old tradition. Therefore, a lot of big rabbanim were against it. And all hell broke loose. It was big brouhaha in the late 1500s. As we know, the printers went through it anyway. And they found, you know, enough rabbanim to write haskamas on it. You know, l'havdol, the way the art scroll did when they first started with the Gemara. And it's still in front of every art scroll Gemara. You see, Rav Gifter, Rav Yashav, this and that. I don't blame them. It's to say, maybe some people tied against the art scroll Gemara. But we got some big gedolim, and of course they do. No question about it. And therefore they say it's kosher. And it's good. Nebiyak Kamenetsky, open any art scroll Gemara. I think it's still in the front. Right? So, you know, it's that way. Okay, it's that way. Now, I don't think this is so well known, but understand that the decision to put this in the print was like a biggie. I'm not even getting in today, as I'm here just, like I say, without anything, getting into the fact that the printers actually sort of created the Zohar in some literary aspects, because you're talking about the different parts of the Zohar and where they should be put. And they used to be in manuscripts. You know, the Rei Mehem was this, and the Tikkun HaZohar was that. Probably most of you don't even know what I'm talking about. So, aside from that, the very idea of publicizing and using the most modern technology, which was the printing press, was extremely controversial. We have to understand that the 16th century is indeed a watershed, a century of change in Judaism in ways that we don't appreciate. Because of the invention of the printing press, and I think most of you know that the main place, in fact, for a long time, the only place where important sforim were published, meaning in printing press, was Italy. In the late 1400s and throughout the 1500s. Now, the Italians allowed this to happen because it brought in money. People publish books, usually make a living. It's legal. Nothing immoral about it. Because it was Italy in the Renaissance era, so the government was very anti-Semitic, and usually they didn't allow a Jew to simply print the book and all and run off with the money. And usually you had to have a guy in there. We know, I assume you know, that the famous, because I've talked about it in the past, I don't expect you know all different things I talked about. I don't remember them all myself. But I recall, if you talk about the famous Bromberg press, Daniel Bromberg was a guy from Belgium. He came to Italy. He really got hooked on the idea of publishing these Hebrew books. Nobody knows why. Adhiyom is that. But he was a real businessman. He was enthusiastic with the project. And because he was a Christian, he got permission from the Republic of Venice to, you know, publish the Shas and the Mikra Gedolos and the Yerushalmi and all the other stuff. Now, imagine, close your eyes for a minute, imagine what it was like, you know, 600, 700, 800 years ago, if you were in yeshiva and you're coming in for the first monitor, whatever. Now, let's say for argument's sake, you're learning Baba Kama. Aside from the fact you have to get a dorm room and worry about, you know, where you're going to get your meals. Seriously, right? Anybody knows what I'm talking about. Where are you going to get a book? Today, they'll say like this, the yeshiva will sell the books, or they'll tell you to go to the bookstore. If you're in a town with a bookstore, or nowadays you can order everything online, right? Get it almost instantly. If you wish to, I mean, they don't do this in yeshivas. You know, you can get the whole thing on, the whole thing is printed online, you know, in the Safari or this one, that, the other. Somebody showed me the other day, I don't quite understand exactly, the Masifta seemed to be online if you know how to do it. So, it's a new world. But if you lived hundreds of years ago, time of the Rishonim, for example, and you're learning Baba Kama this year, where are you going to get a Baba Kama? You've got to get a hold of a manuscript copy, which has the text of the Talmud in it. You've got to get a hold of another thing called the text of Rashi, unless you happen to get a high-end type item that has on the same page, written out by hand, a Gemara and a Rashi. And then you can imagine how hard it is to get a Tosis. You get what I'm saying? Thus, to physically access this stuff was very difficult. I doubt, I could be wrong, I doubt if everybody in yeshiva had full copies and things like this. probably they had like a swarm area, you know, and you could go and access it or read it. And if it's a manuscript culture, which is before the printing press, everybody was expected to copy it out themselves. There's no such thing as copyright in a manuscript culture. The opposite. When you see a book, let's say you're a guy and you read a book of Aristotle or Homer or something like that. If you like it, you copy it. Now, if you can't, you say it's a pain in the neck, or I'm not good, I don't have a good handwriting, all the rest of it, then you have no choice but to try to buy it. Or else commission somebody, you know, to write out for you. It could be your brother-in-law and sister-in-law, and their handwriting might be fantastic. But that's the best you can afford. If you're richer, you can get somebody with calligraphy. You know what I'm saying? The famous Dictuque Sophron, the Munich Codex, which is such a masterpiece. Well, that was for a Richie Rich. Richie Rich still a Richie Rich. It was on the same page, all the stuff, in beautiful letters, in gold, ink around the letters, and so on and so forth, with some hand-written, illustrated, illustrations. I mean, it was a super high-end item, okay? That ain't for the regular yeshiva guy or the regular rabbi or even Dayan or something like that out there. They had to make do with a lot less. Now, in major centers of scholarship, yeshivas or something like that, the head guys, the rabbis, the rashivas, whatever, kind of made it their business to try to get a hold of as many manuscripts as they could and, you know, use them for girsas and things like that. I'm talking about the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ramban, the Rambam, probably, Rashi, and all, you know, that's how they operate. All of this began to be changed once you have something called a printed edition of the entire Shas, like Bromberg's edition in what, the 1520s or whatever it was. Later Yishalm even, Mikras Gedolas, things like that. You know what I'm saying? All of a sudden, all those manuscript copies kind of go into desuetude. Not overnight. And there was a while where people still tried to hold on to the old man. You know, there's all people who say Chodesh is Asur Min HaTorah. And therefore, you know, you can't have a printed book. But that didn't last too long. Any more than the opposition to Art Scroll or that kind of thing lasted, didn't last too long. I mean, there's some against it, but the Velt is into it. You know, because usually technology triumphs over everything else. That's usually the lesson of history. Now, that means that starting 1500s, headquartered in Italy, for a long time in Venice, but then some other places in Ferrara, in Mantua, for example, our city, we were talking about, developed printing presses simply because somebody moved there. And it's a way of making a buck. It's legal. And so you get a manuscript that people like, let's say, for example, the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, or something, and you print a set of that, you're going to sell them. What I'm trying to say is like this, it'll be a profit-making enterprise. So if I'm a printer, I go to a couple of rich guys, and I say like this, I have a business venture. There's nothing wrong with what I'm saying. You know, it's a legitimate business venture. And, you know, invest this and much, and so on and so forth. And you know and I know, if we put out a set of Rambam or Tour or whatever it is, it will sell. Question is, how much? So that's businessman talk. Okay? So this is what happened. Now, it always was Nigla, not Nister. Okay? It was Nigla. The famous business that you have in the Gnosim Kal this year is when they broke that taboo and, you know, opened the floodgates. Not in Venice, and not in Padua, but in Mantua, and also near, not too far away in Cremona. Cremona, you probably don't remember. I did a thing on Rabbi Ottolenghi, the guy who does those Kitzer Piske, you know, Riff and Ron and all that stuff in the back. Kitzer Piske and Muki Yosef and all that. In Cremona. I think it's like 50 miles away from Mantua. These are all places in northern central Italy. You have to know where they are. But, I mean, the whole city, the whole Jewish community was 450 people. The Mantua was three times that, you know, like close to 1,500 people. These are small communities. So I've remarked many times, from these small communities in terms of quantity, sometimes they end up publishing and disseminating the most significant texts. It doesn't have to be a large city. A printing press is just a printing press. You need the guys in charge. You need the press. You need the letters and the old-fashioned way of doing it. You know, I take this. Now, the problem that popped up with the printing press in the 1500s is it coincided with the Renaissance and the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. The Renaissance was about Italy and other places starting to be interested in stuff other than purely Christian. So that could be good. Like a Bromberg guy could say like this. Excuse me, I'm not Jewish. I'm publishing the Talmud Bavli because it's an ancient document. People want to know about it. Same way people are interested in Homer and Aristotle and Plato and all the business. She's interested in Chinese stuff if we had it. And also ancient Hebrew texts. Even rabbinic texts. I don't think we follow them. It could be a bunch of baloney. But we want to know the ancient baloney. I mean, that was how Bromberg sold it to the Christians. So the Renaissance was a plus in that, you know, publishing, disseminating classical texts was considered something good. The Protestant Reformation, which started in Germany, was not so good because very anti-Semitic, as Martin Luther times and all the rest of it. They ain't interested in any Jewish books being circulated. But if there are any books being circulated, they want to penetrate them and try to prove Christianity from them. And that's how that went. But then the Protestant Reformation provoked the Catholic Counter-Reformation, which is what it sounds like. The Catholic Church, like, counterattacked, and they got really stark and machmir. And even though their primary enemy was the Protestants, but the Jews are collateral damage. And the Catholic councils started getting very stark against the Jews. And sooner or later, it hit the books. I don't have time today to go through all the details. We've talked in the past, also for Gnosim, I think, about the Justiniani Rambam and those kind of stories. Bottom line is, the Jews were stupid. We always are. And if the publishing guys would have been few and far between and kept their mouth shut and not engaged in any machlokes with other Jews or other competitors, then it probably would have been okay. But you know how it goes. You start publishing a copy of something, and then I start publishing a copy, and I want mine to sell, you want yours to sell, and we start arguing with each other, and sooner or later, it goes to the Geisha courts, or the Geisha Welt. And when that happens, the Geisha say, like, it's the Catholics in Renaissance Italy, Counter-Reformation Italy, actually. We don't call it the Renaissance after the middle of 1500s. We call it more the Counter-Reformation. Or now, we live in an age of politically correct. So they don't call it the Counter-Reformation, what they call it the Catholic Reformation. But it's the same business. And all of a sudden, you know, they say, what the heck is going on over here? The Jews are publishing all these books. And they have blasphemies. They say negative things against Yashka or things like that. And anyway, why should they be allowed to maintain a whole separate civilization? This is a problem that went back to the 13th century. Until then, the Catholics didn't even know that there's such a thing called the Talmud, except in the vaguest way. And only a few of them knew that the Talmud contains negative things about Yashka and others. And there were books that were written by them, but who read books in the Middle Ages? You see what I'm saying? Very small literacy. Didn't have that much of a play until naturally a Meshumad screwed everything up. Nicholas Donen in the 1200s, and he converted. It's a whole long story. And he told on the Jews, and he told to the Archbishop of Paris, who told the Pope. And that, of course, as we know, resulted in the burning of all the Gemaras and all the Hebrew books in Paris that we've talked about before. I know you've heard that before. But what could the Jews do? Whenever the Jews were persecuted by the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, the only thing they could do was go to the Pope and plead with him. That's all they could do. And the Jews went to the Pope in the 1200s, and they said, we need the Gemaras and all the rest of it to run the Jewish religion. You yourself, as the head of the Roman Catholic Church, agree that we have the right to practice our religion, even though you formally tell us that religion is stupid and all the rest of it. Yeah, we know. But nevertheless, Messiah of Sinai Biodenu, and the Catholic Church, according to its traditions and teachings, is gyrus that, you know. I know you're waiting for us to one day wake up and accept Yashka, but until then, and we need the Gemaras, and by the time it was over, the Pope said, okay, you can publish censored Gemaras. You know what I'm saying? Censored. And so, from then on, now we're talking about the 1200s. There was no printing press. So the Jews, if they were smart, wouldn't put in anything about Yashka, you know, this Chesronus HaShas, anything about Christianity, all the rest of it. because why provoke them again and burn everything? They burned thousands of books, which were rare, already in the 1200s and the 1240s. Why should they go weiter and cause more trouble? You understand that. Here and there, there were some frumies, of course, who said, no, we want to keep the pristine text. The Munich Codex, the Dictuque Servum, is like that. It has all the anti-Christian passages in it. I don't know how they did it, but, you know, let's put it this way. He must live in a place where nobody else could read the Gemara, so nobody will know. If you had a Meshumet or two, and the dangerous Meshumet is the ex-Yeshiva guy. There always were some ex-Yeshiva guys that converted throughout the history. Not many, but there's always some. Always some. And they tell. They squeal. So, this was in the pre-printing press. But when the printing press arose, as I told you, it was real technology. That became the way to go. Ad kedei kach, that the manuscript culture died out, because people had printed books. Then, just as we're discovering today in the 21st century, the increased technology actually helps Big Brother to hold a bigger control over the private lives of people. Notice to snoop and sneak and stick their nose into your private life. You know, and I know, just what your phone, Uncle Sam, if they want to, knows everything about you, where you were. Isn't it true you pass by a place and then it says, what do you think of this store? You'll go on the internet for something and all of a sudden it'll throw at you, what do you think of this and this thing that you like? If they know from somewhere you like swimming, all of a sudden you get swimming advertisements. If you know you like Rambam, you get Rambam advertisements. How do they know that? You see? So, like, we can't do anything about it. Right? What am I supposed to do? Not have a phone at all? And so, you know, the Big Brother's watching. Same way, mutandis, it was more primitive, of course. In the old days, once you have printing presses, then the actual physical creation of the books is centralized to the place of the printing press. That facilitated the Catholic Church to exercise control, and they did. And they said, you can't have a printing press unless it's approved by the church. And there have to be censors that go over every single item that's printed without their permission. You can't do it. They even published a Sefer HaZikuk, you know, with bad expressions that they heard about. Don't say Goy, say Akun, you know, things like that. But, and Yeshu leave it all out. And that's how the books were published, if you wanted them to be published at all. All the Jews could say was, we didn't mean the Christians, we didn't mean Yashka, we mean something else. The Catholic Church wasn't stupid. So it was something that they would allow, at least censored books. But every once in a while, you could have a pope who was a mamzer and a half, and particularly in the 1550s, you had Paul the Fourth, who was not a mamzer and a half, he was a mamzer and two halves. He was bad news. Even the Catholics agreed to that. You understand? When he died, they threw his body into, I forget, into the river or something like that. While he was there, and he went against the Jews. And he said, by the way, if you know his history, he said, you know, you're electing me, I'm Mamash and SOB, I'm mourning you. That's who I am. And he was. And he interested in Inquisition. He was a terrible guy. And he's the one who started the Catholic Reformation, anti-Semitism, big time, against the Jews in Italy and other Catholic countries. And part of that was burning all the books. So thousands of Gemaras and Sfarim and things like that were burnt by him in the 1550s. When he died, I think it was 1559 maybe, his successor was Pius IV, who was a good guy compared to the first guy. The Jews said, oh, this is much better. And they appealed to him, and he allowed him to do the old system, which was you could publish things as long as it doesn't say Gemara in the front, Talmud. You know, but as it was tough being a frum Jew in Italy after the 1550s, and very often there was an absence of Gemaras, a physical absence, and you couldn't do anything about it. And those rabbis who had whole sets was very rare, and you had to guard this against Malshinin. It was terrible, okay? It was just terrible. Now, what if you're a regular yeshiva guy? And you're in Italy in the second half of 1500s. I mean, what do you do if there are no books? You get what I'm saying? What do you do if there are no books? Now, the Catholic Church had the Talmud in its gun sights. They did more; they burned more than the Talmud, but primarily that's because they mistook the other books for the Talmud. they didn't go all the way to say any Hebrew book b'chlal to be burned, but they were moving in that direction. Now, Pope Pius IV didn't do that. Some later popes kind of did here and there. And there was a reign of terror. If you're an Italian from Jew, rabbi, a gadol, if you lived in the later 1500s and the 1600s, if you remember Azariah Figo, when he wrote the Gedulei Truma, he said, I only have like 3 Gemaras available to me here in Pisa. Maybe 4. There weren't any Gemaras. Okay? So what do you do when, as a result of political oppression, there are no books? You see, you and I know the whole culture of Torah learning is dependent on having books, texts. If you don't have them, then I don't have to persecute you. I don't have to prevent you physically from keeping mitzvahs. I don't have to shut down your shul, all the rest of it. You're screwed because you don't have any books. Right? How many, Bill Nagons out there that have it all memorized? Like the Chapita or something like that? Yeah, none. Hardly. And so, what do you do? So, I'm giving you now a dystopian, novel, like a Fahrenheit 451 situation. What if somebody came in America or wherever, and they simply got rid of all the books and blocked it on the internet? So you got big yeshivas, Lakewood, near Israel, Kleinberg, whatever, right? And there are guys that want to learn, and they really do, and it's not possible because there are no books available. This would be a bummer gadol. Welcome to, Italy, particularly in the late 16th century and 17th century, and some other Catholic countries as well. They did this every once in a while in Prague also, which was part of the Catholic Austrian Empire. And this is like a sad parsha in history, Klal Yisrael. Now, what did the Jews do? One way, and this is what they eventually did a lot, was to publish the Rif. So in other words, it's not the same thing as the Gemara, but on the other hand, it's second best. Because as you know, the Rif wrote a kitzur of the Gemara, and it was called Alfas. It wasn't called Talmud. And if you bribed the right people, this and the other, the church was willing to say, okay, it's not a Talmud, so it's not part of the Gezerah, provided this Rif stuff doesn't have anything against Christianity or objectionable from a Christian point of view. Okay? That's one way of doing it. Another way, and that's what we're talking about in terms of the Genozim catalog, another way is, what about Kabbalistic literature? Now, here you have an interesting case because the Kabbalah came out of the closet with the publication, I can't use the word publication, but with the publicizing of the Zohar in the late 1200s by Moshe de Leon in Spain. That means it was circulating in the 1300s, if you did late 1200s, in the 1300s and 1400s, so 200 years. So think about that. There wasn't any printing of the Zohar because there's no printing press. The Zohar is a big document, especially if you throw in all different parts, like I said before, the Rabba, the Drizuta, the Rebbe Mehemna, the Tikkuni Zohar, the Zohar Chaim, all that stuff. So it's pretty big. It's like copying out like a little Gemara or something like that. Right? I'm not talking about the other Kabbalistic books. That's also true. The Mefarshim, the Rukhanani was out, and some of these other things were out. Right? Good. Let it be. But they could only circulate with handwritten copies. The Kabbalists actually were okay with that because Bechlal, publishing the Zohar, meaning publicizing it, and allowing copies to be made from it by the Hamun on, was itself a revolutionary Kiddush, which was pretty controversial in its day. You know what I'm saying? Aside the arguments that came up when the Zohar was put out there, I'll use the word published even though I don't mean with a printing press, because there wasn't any until the late 1400s. So, Moshe Leon started putting out copies of this. First of all, some people said it's a forgery, and that's from that day till today. I told you before, Rabbi Yitzhak of Akko goes there and he hears this rumor and that rumor, and he talked to Moshe Leon himself. That's one controversy. Now, let's put that aside. Here's the second controversy. Let's say that you accept that it's real and that it's not a forgery. And this Moshe de Leon found a 1,000-year-old manuscript or something like that. As not making copies of it. Who gave you the right to do that? You get what I'm saying? Who gave you the right to do that? Covered Olim Hester Dover. You're not supposed to talk about this stuff in public. Those who are meant to know about it, Hashem will do like the Rizal story. They'll come to know about it. You understand? Those who are not, you'll see. They won't. It's better that way. Because this kind of chokhmah should only be for the few. It's better if it's only for the few. Get what I'm saying? That's the way it's supposed to be. If it's only for the few. And this is a whole separate argument. Get what I'm saying? Most historians are focused on the question of the forgery or not forgery or this, that, and the other. Chutz from that, people say, who gave you the right to do this? But he died not too long afterwards, and the cat was out of the bag, and copies were just being made. So, there's nothing to talk about. Compare, as they always say this, compare Moshe de Leon on the one hand with the Ramban on the other. The Ramban on the Chumash wants to tell you the Kabbalah stuff. He's always conflicted on this, but he always holds himself back, does he not? That's like the classic on the Ramban. He wants to tell you, but he doesn't. That's the way. Because you're not supposed to talk about it. And here Moshe de Leon, of course, did talk about it. Aside the fact that he wrote his own Sfarim on Kabbalistic subjects, and so did others. So in the 1300s and the 1400s, there was a subculture of Kabbalah, as you and I call it today, of this particular form of mysticism. But, you know, it wasn't really studied out in the Rishus HaRabbah. And people quoted from here and there. So people had the idea out there. The Hamonam had the idea. There's some heavy mystical stuff out there. And I heard a Vart here, and a Vart there, and a Vart there. I don't really know the stuff. I know a couple of Kabbalistic Varts I heard. You know, that's how people talked. Now, in the 1550s, with this Mamzer and a half Pope, Paul IV, who really was bad news. You know, he's the one who wrote that issue, the famous bull, Cum Nimis Absurdus. Since it's absurd that the Jews who killed our Lord should walk around just like everybody else have freedom, I'm going to put an end to this. And he did. So, what a hilaria. Anyway, he eventually turned into burning all the books. Right? All the Sfarim, all the Gemaras and things like that. However, during those 2 centuries, when the Kabbalah was out there in manuscript form, some Christians found out about it, and some Christians were drawn to it, not because they saw the emes of Kabbalah, but because they came convinced, yeah, since the Kabbalah has all these funny expressions over here, and parts of it could be read possibly as a, like, confirming Christianity. I know it's not, but I'm just saying that's how they read it. Especially the Trinities and things like that. I'm not going to go into that. Suffice it to say that there were those Christian intellectuals who said, you know, the Jews have a treasure in their hands, but the Jews are too stupid to understand what it is because it's really a Christian text which proves Yashka and everything else. Just the Jews are too dumb or too stubborn to admit it. Now, what that means is that in the Christian world, they say like this, the Gemara is baloney, but the Zohar is there something. You see? I realize it's screwy, but this is how life went. And because what I just said, you had the rise of what you call the Christian Kabbalists, for example, who are interested in certain Kabbalistic stuff. Believe it or not, Martin Luther wrote a book, and he was a terrible hilaria, on the Shem HaMforesh, and Reuchlin wrote a book, you know, the guy who hated Jews but defended the Talmud from being burned by the Dominicans, I think. And he wrote a thing on Kabbalah. And Pico della Mirandola. People that most of you never heard of, who were important figures once upon a time in the Renaissance culture, in the Christian culture, and they spoke very highly of the Zohar. They spoke very lowly of the Gemara. They're highly of the Zohar, which they only had, you know, in manuscript form, and some of which began to translate some of it into Latin and other languages. This is part of the screwball history of the Zohar. Very screwball. And so, now you are in the late 1500s in Italy, or the late 1550s, and you're hit with this terrible gzeirah that they burned at the stake in one place after another throughout Italy. Thousands and thousands of Gemaras and things like this, which really put a lot of yeshivas out of business because they couldn't help doing that. As I said before, if such thing happened, chas v'shalom. Now, what would everybody in near Israel do? What would everybody in Lakewood do? What would everybody in Muncie do? I mean, all joking aside, there's no books, nothing. I mean, you show up at 9 in the morning to daven, and then what? What do you do all day? There's no books. See? Ken of Jerusalem, just by heart, I ask you, you're the Rosh Hashiva, what do you do? So as I'll try to show you in a second, this is a big crisis, and different things started to happen. To some degree, people went off the derech. To some degree, they started studying Haskalah stuff, Jewish medieval Haskalah stuff. To some degree, they went into Limudi Chol. One possible, eventually, they came up with the Rif idea, not right away. One possibility, not the only one, is Kabbalah. Why Kabbalah? They could actually get permission from the Catholic Church. This is the remarkable part, to publish the Zohar, because the Church was convinced, or convinced itself, that this will inevitably lead the Jews to become Christian. And that's why in 1558, 59, the Church gave permission for a couple of books of Kabbalah, and especially the Zohar of all things, which was a monumental project, as you can imagine. I'm talking about the old printing, not the modern, desktop publishing. I'm talking about you had to carve out the letters and put on the page and all the rest of it to publish this. A few years later, like 3 or 4 years later, the Church came to the conclusion that they made a mistake. And the Zohar is not going to lead to the mass conversion of the Jews. Maybe the opposite. And make them more insular than before. Which is true. And then they wanted to burn the Zohar, but by that time, the old Mamzer was dead, and they had Pope Paul, they had Pope Pius IV, and he was better. And they ended up not doing that. Let's put it that way. So now you have the issue in this atmosphere of crisis that I just described. The yeshivas are falling apart. You guys don't know what to learn. Maybe they had some Rambams around, so the Seder is composed of learning Mishnah Torah. That's a funny limud. I'm not against it, but it's a funny limud, And the time I'm talking about, you had the Torah, you didn't have the Beis Yosef yet, because it was being published during these years, essentially. So, do you get what I'm saying? If you were head of a school or yeshiva, and you're not allowed to print the Gemara, but you want to keep the yeshiva and want to keep the guys in derech, what books would you strive to use and get permission for that would keep some kind of learning, even though it wouldn't be the same thing as it was before? That's an interesting challenge I'm laying out to you guys. You understand? Like, what would you do? So, one of the things, as I said before, was the print of Zohar. Now, you have to understand, there's the Shema and the Lo Lishma in every business adventure. Whoever was going to print the Zohar, so this is going to be a moneymaker, baby. Because since the absence of the Gemara, people will buy this. There's a lot of money and profit going to be made from this, which was true. On the other hand, you can also say, it's Lishma, you're spreading knowledge of God, spreading Torah of a certain sort. You can already start to see the funny business that the printing of Zohar, in a place like Mantua, which had always been a major makom of Shas, of Gemara, as I tried to explain. Mantua is not associated, not in my mind, with the big Kabbalists, but rather the Litvisha types. You understand? Shas, Poskim, even Haskalah, again, in the Frum way. music, strength, things like that. A very rich culture in terms of, Gemara and Nigla. A very rich culture. Not a place on Nistor so much. Right? But of course, maybe I'm wrong, because the Nistor guys kept it as Nistor. You know what I mean? Because you weren't supposed to talk about it. And now, it's all being put into the public domain. And who knows what this will lead to. And so naturally, two opinions form. among the big rabbanim in Italy, because it's an Italian business, for and against, right? Those against, as we shall see now, start in a minute, started saying this will cause a lot of trouble. And they weren't wrong, because it led to Shabtai Tzvi. Now, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, but Shabtai Tzvi couldn't have happened without the printing, the press, the publishing of the Zohar, and putting it out there in the public domain. Of course, a couple will argue, say that's not what it was, but that's what it was. Now, they didn't say Shabtai Tzvi, but they said it'll cause trouble. Those who were in favor formed into a lot of different groups. And that's when I want to take a beginning today. This will be two or three parts. I can't help it. As long as Shabbos afternoon, I'm already going long. But I brought with me to Florida one book. That's all I could bring. But it's very good. You know, I'm a big fan of Simcha Asaf, as I say over and over again. He's the best historian. And I'm not talking about his four-volume Makoros that told us Achinuch B'Yisrael. That's also good. But he also, over the years, published a lot of articles. And every once in a while, like in the 40s, he would publish them as, you know, in a collection of essays. The most famous of which, I think, is the Ole Yaakov, but I'm not talking about that. Fortunately, I don't know where, but I see in 2003, I picked up a collection of some of his essays, which are called Mech Karim, something or other like that. It's, his stuff is always a treasure, to me anyway, to me. And Mekorot Mech Karim B'Toldos Yisrael. It's a bland title. And these are different articles he published over the years in all kind of subjects. Right? He was, as you know, a giant Talmud Chacham. He's also a giant historian. And, I mean, he really knows his stuff. And one of the things he published was an unknown manuscript of a letter written in the context of what they call the Pulmus al-Hadpasas Sifri Kabbalah. The polemic, the arguments, the machlokas that rose in literary form among the Italian rabbis over the very question of whether it's appropriate or not to print in the printing press Kabbalistic books, or should you still keep it just in the Ksaviyah? It shouldn't get out there. The Kisri Arid that they call, for example, which came later, wasn't printed until the Chassidim, for the most part, in the 1780s. So the Arid died in 1572, and Chaim Vital died, he's the one who wrote this stuff, in 1620. Wasn't for another 160 years that the Hasidim, for a very variety of reasons, in the late 1700s started publishing these books in printing presses. So I'm trying to share with you a little bit of a taste of the tension between, you know, the idea of disseminating this stuff as much as possible versus the opposite, covet al him hester dover and don't. And talking about disseminating in the sense of putting it in a printing press, or should you, you know, keep it away? Now today, this whole question is moot for a whole bunch of reasons. But since we have now, you know, most people came on from, the academic world got interested in Kabbalah. Now, every kind of Kabbalistic manuscript is being published in magazines and online. And, yeah, it's just a new world. And most people don't pay attention to it because they're not Bar Hochi. But some basic things like the Zohar and the basic history are biggies. And a lot of people are into that. So, was it the right thing to do or not? Anyway, so this historian, Simcha Asaf, has what I always regard as a wonderful article on this. I'll read parts of it for you, especially when we get into the actual letter that he's publishing here for the first time. But his Hakdama is, in my opinion, fantastic. And I will try, within the space of the time I have left today, to read you this two or three page Hakdama, because I hold from it. And he goes as follows. Bishnas Shin Yud Resh, or maybe Shin Yud Dal, really, or something like that. Or Shin Yud Ches is probably a mistake. Even in the printed, it's a mistake. In the year 1558, I think it was, or maybe a little earlier. Nigzer mitama pifya polo revi tzara yudim, gzera srefa srevas Sifri HaTalmud ben Parsha, that this mamzer, the Pope Paul IV, issued a gzera to burn all the Gemaras. Uma Farsha. Oz nivrisu bevenis levada Yosem Elf Exemplary Mitomet. So in Venice, they burned this, where the printing press was, they burned 1,000 volumes of the Gemara. Chamesh Mosman Alfas. And in addition to that, they also burned 500 copies of the Alfas, which I told you was a separate thing. And Shar Swarm in case, quote unquote. And a belt of other Swarm. So the Venetians, who were Mamzerim also, generally speaking, even though they did give the Jews, you know, law and order, but they were pretty cholera about it. So they burned the belt of physical books. Hataman Hosel was Justiniani in Venice that we talked about, Avikimakula. It's the entire set of the Justiniani Gemara, which was a big, commercial venture that Gaim financed. The whole thing was burned. Who Adin Lotzos Bromberg Ashlishis, the entire third edition of the Bromberg, Shas, and other Svarim, was all destroyed. Afmin Masechta Shenidvisu, so it was a catastrophe. Afmin Masechta Shenidvisu B'Sabianeta, and the Gemaras that were published in Sabianeta, which is right near Mantua, in the middle 1550s, Sardar Rak Exemplar. Only a few copies have survived. So if you ever get one of these on Gnosim, or one of these other places, I mean, these are rare survivors of the burning holocaust of the books. B'chol Italia Nishar Asrakam Miklat Achar Echad L'Sifri Talmud Farshab. In the whole Italy, at that moment, was only one place where it was safe to have Gemaras and stuff like that, Cremona, which is, like I say, 50, 60, 70 miles away. Why? Because Cremona was under Takas HaShulchan HaSfaradim Shenuchu B'Sushim HaPivyat. Because there was a war going on at that time, if you know European history, which you don't, between the Pope on the one hand and the King of Spain on the other. And therefore, at that particular moment, the King of Spain, who hated Jews, said, we're not going to force any of the decrees of the Pope. And the Jews tried to maneuver within that, and they had a publishing house in Cremona and all the rest of it. B'Yerzu Hekim Yosef Atalengi Yeshiva Gedola. I told you this, Yosef Atalengi was a big rabbi, and he had a yeshiva there. I don't know about Yeshiva Gedola, but he had a yeshiva. Hamid Beis Tfus Mefor, Lahatpi Svarim Rabbi Gedola. And he started publishing a lot of Svarim over there, because it was like the Ari Miklat, the only place where this burning Gzerah didn't apply, like the Tour and others. B'Yerzu Echbrichu Rabbi Yehuda Talia Sifreim, the other Jews in Italy sent their surviving copies to Cremona because they figured it's an ir miklat. But ulam achshavsa milchama v'mishal sfarad apifyar. But when that war concluded, I remember the Spanish, who had the best army in the world, defeated the army of the Pope. The Duke of Alba, the famous Spanish general, crushed the papal army, and then he went to the Pope, who was totally defeated, and kissed his foot. It's a very Spanish thing to do. In other words, politically, militarily, we're against you, but religiously, we're Catholic. You see? So that made a peace of conquest by the Spanish. And then they enforced the papal decrees against the books and burned everything in Cremona. You see what I'm saying? So it was a terrible decade. Achshamsa Mechombe Michel's Sfar Lapifyar, Chola Gzera Cremona, and in 1559, Nistri Pubab Kaseris Alofim Tifri Talmud. 10,000 volumes of Gemara. B'kim shenit m'shul samashchis l'b'chim ein sifri atalman l'svar m'cher. In addition to 10,000 copies of Gemara, thousands of other copies that they thought were Gemaras. You know, didn't matter. But Osi is different since they were in Hebrew letters. And they basically destroyed the book legacy, physical book legacy in Italy. So it was a catastrophe. Okay? That's what it was. Now, Sreifas Atalmud, Nodach Reda Shinuim Chashum B'Chayim Aruchnim Shayhudi Italia. So I just told you, what's the consequence of burning all the books? You know, what's the result? Think about that. It had tremendous impact, obviously, on the spiritual life of the Jews in Italy. B'Shpial Hispashtus HaKabbalah Mitzarecha, and it had a hashpah on the spread of Kabbalah, as we shall see on one hand. Limud HaMikra, also, it's going to affect learning Tanakh, because Bibles they didn't burn. Haloshon Ivrit, Madom Kol Mitzad Sheni. That was what they called the Haskalah stuff. Poetry, philosophy, grammar, If you know, those kind of books were spared. So you have a dangerous situation. The Gemaras are gone, but other Hebrew books are around. You see what I'm saying? There are two people right about that time, Mincha Blul and someone else. The Mincha Blul, the Rappaport, is a rabbi in northern Italy. And the first one says, Ha'echad kosa, quote, Me'achre lukcha mimenu ha'gemara, Nismal ha'arts mekukbolin bali ha'chachma elohis, Yoshe b'seis re'olion, Amistakam b'spaklari mi'ira. He's going crazy. He says, ever since they burned the Gemara, all these Kabbalah guys are popping up like mushrooms. Maybe they claim to know Asbaklar Mi'ira. Now, he obviously doesn't believe that. So, in other words, it's a happy hunting ground for phonies. Right? Because, again, if it's a quote-unquote yeshivisha type culture, which Italy had been until now. So, generally speaking, in a yeshivisha type culture, if a guy doesn't know how to learn Gemara well, but he says he knows Kabbalah, we go, you know, real guys should know Gemara. But there weren't any Gemaras left. So all these guys, he complains, the Mincha Blul are popping up like mushrooms, and they're causing terrible trouble. And then there's Rabbi Yehuda Asayel, these are all famous Italian rabbis once upon a time, where he says, Beglilo Seinu Ela, Ein Rashut, in our area in Italy, Ein Rashut Nesunami Adonai Yars Lachzi Talmud B'Yodenin, the government doesn't allow us to have any Gemaras. Ubekoshi hitiru mashitiru. And b'dieved, you know, we got, like I told you, a couple of riffs and things like that. B'glal d'abarzei yeshus b'yom v'onus ha'panai. So what does that mean for the average yeshiva guy? There's not a first seder, a second seder, a third seder anymore. It's no such thing as hasmona because there are no books. So what do you do? Yeshus b'yom. You end up having a lot of time on your hands. They go into Kabbalah stuff, into Tanakh, Dikri Kaloshan, grammar, V'af Gam L'Chokhmas HaChutz, and Limerichol. Meaning, it's not that there was all of a sudden a Haskalah movement, and everybody said, oh, wow, let's all get into Limerichol. There was no Limerich Kodesh, because the books have been burned. Okay? Bote Zman Otsmu Shenigzru Ala Talmud Sifri Aposkim Hayod Tlim Yisra Heter. So in these years, when the Pope had burned the Gemaras, and you didn't know what he's going to do with the Halacha books, it was up and down. But yes, it's from Hotel Censura Gemara. And I told you that the Counter-Reformation put a heavy censorship on any Hebrew book that they would allow to be published in any print press that was left. They started to publish Kabbalistic texts for the first time in printing press. The first thing was Marech Zelhusa Peretz HaKohen, that the safe Marech Zelhusa is a famous Kabbalah book in Ferrar in 1558. B'shein is B'mantua B'shana B'rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni. So here we are. We're now in Adar Rishon, soon to be Adar Sheni. It's the anniversary, 1558 till today. What? How many years is that? You figure it out. Had Pasasim Tikuni Azor B'mantua that the first thing they published was Tikkuni Zohar in the winter of 1550, be around the beginning of the year 1558. And then the Zohar was physically printed in Mantua in 1559-1560, and was also allowed in Cremona, because I told you they had a printing press over there also. They thought it would be an Ari Mikla. It didn't, but they had a printing press. So the two classic printings are the Zohar, is the first in Mantua, and the second is Cremona. I don't remember in the Gnosim, I don't think they have the Cremona one. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But they have the Mantua one. And the question is, how did all hell break loose? What was the big fight that broke out among the rabbis, whether or not it's allowed to publish, to print in Mantua or anywhere else, something like the Zohar? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it the right thing to do? Is it the wrong thing to do? And the biggies lined up on both sides. Nice, an hour already. So let me pick this up on Sunday. I hope I'll have time. And we'll carry the story forward. So again, but this very controversial copy, which was a nice piece of printing, as you see, That's what's being auctioned at the physical volume, or it's a set, is what's being auctioned in the Gnosim, I think March 3 and March 5. Anyway, I'm running out of time here, so I wish everybody a good Shabbos, and you'll hear from me, I guess, still in Orlando, before I'm gone. I plan anyway.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.